May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. The story of branding Coca-Cola in China is one of the classic stories of marketing success. When the soda was first introduced to the mainland Chinese market, the clever people at that multinational knew that what mattered most was making their product appeal to people, not what it actually tasted like. And so the name and the packaging were very important. Coca-Cola became, in Chinese, Kuku Kerle, and the Chinese syllables together translate roughly as tasty and happy. Who wouldn't want to drink a soda like that? Their marketing strategy worked so well that Pepsi and others have tried similar phonetic equivalents. The Christian church tried something similar in explaining what appears in the chalice at the Eucharist on Sunday mornings. At the beginning of the service, bread and wine are brought to the altar, and the community, led by the priest, prays over the elements. For the faithful, the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Christ. And as each person comes forward to receive the sacrament, the wine is offered with the words, "The blood of Christ shed for you," in the traditional prayer book language. But more contemporary liturgy has sought to frame it a little differently. Blood of Christ isn't appealing to a new Christian who doesn't understand the nuances of that. So the alternatives that are offered are the cup of salvation and the wine of new life. Seems blood is a difficult thing to sell. So, though, is alcohol. There are branches of the Christian church which frown on the consumption of alcoholic beverages and substitute grape juice at communion. The Anglican Church continues to use bread and wine as the elements of communion because it's described in that Last Supper that Jesus had with his friends when he began or instituted this meal. But our church is mindful of the fact that alcohol is a problem in our society, just as it was right from Jesus' day and before. Wine can have both positive and negative connotations. So how do we understand wine in our Christian context? Well, wine is a drink of celebration. It's a symbol of sharing and generosity, something you bring to parties, something you open when your friends come over. It's not usually an everyday drink now, but in the time of Jesus, it was part of every meal. In earlier times, wine was a slightly lower percentage in alcohol, and it was usually cut with water at meals. But it was still enough to kill some of the bugs in the well. So wine also brought a measure of safety to the meal. And in moderation, as Paul advised Timothy, it helps with both health and happiness. It eases tensions. It opens up conversation. Wine is an essential part of some holidays and special occasions, like weddings, and it was expected and appreciated. From earliest times, however, people recognized that alcohol had a dark side. In the Bible is the story of Noah, who is supposed to be the first cultivator of the vine. He discovered after the flood how to make wine. And the story continues, which is not often read in church on Sunday mornings, of the tragic consequence when he gets drunk and actually lies with his own daughters. There are proverbs, there are stories, there are advice in the Bible on drinking too much. Cautionary tales to warn the faithful people. Alcohol, we know, can lead to addiction and to violence and to family breakdown. You have to be careful with wine. Nevertheless, there had to be wine for that wedding in Cana. Everybody knew that. But somewhere along the way, somebody made a miscalculation. Maybe more people than expected showed up for the reception. Maybe they drank more than was allocated. After all, Jesus and his friends were invited, and we all know that they weren't teetotalers. But in the Gospel of John, chapter 2, during the wedding proceedings, we hear the wine ran out. This was catastrophe. And Mary, the mother of Jesus, comes to her son and informs him of this. "They have no wine," she says bluntly. What a classic delivery line for any mom, because you can feel the unsaid reproach hanging off the end of the sentence. Do something about it. Why was Mary so upset by this lack of libation? Was she worried about the family losing face or status through this lapse in hospitality? Was she worried a fight might break out if they didn't produce more jugs quickly? Or is it that Mary and Jesus, as some have suggested, were actually related to whoever was getting married? And so it was their own family's honor and reputation that was at stake. Or maybe Jesus, as a friend or member of the family, was responsible for getting the wine in the first place. We don't know. But Jesus' reply to Mary, given the circumstances, is rather odd. "Woman, what concern is that to you or me? My hour is not yet come." Well, first I want to clarify that by calling her woman, which sounds pretty cagey to me, he's not actually being disrespectful. But what he's doing is he's distancing himself from the problem. Mary's demanding that Jesus act in some capacity to remedy the situation. She may not be asking him to conjure water into wine, but it may be something as simple as asking him to run down the street to the wine merchant to get more, or even to delegate his disciples to do so, or maybe entertain the guests with a story to distract them from the fact that their cups were empty. Jesus, whatever she's asking, is trying to sidestep her. He doesn't want to draw attention to himself at this point in his ministry. He doesn't want to step on the public stage. But this is the beginning of Jesus becoming public. It's the first of his appearances. And both Mary and Jesus know that he's not really going to ignore the dilemma. A wedding ought to be a joyful, a happy celebration, a new beginning, a sign of life for the community. He wants to be part of that. And of course, the wedding is so much a symbol of what he is doing as he comes to be the bridegroom of Israel. So, message delivered by Mom, message understood by Jesus. And now Mary takes a step back and leaves him to it. "Just do whatever he tells you," she tells the waiters. And she goes back inside confident that God will provide with Jesus' help. And Jesus does provide something to drink. He provides water. He tells the servants to fill up some big stone jars with water. They hold about 100 liters each. These are big jars. And they're to dip their pitchers in it and take that out and take it into the banquet. We don't actually hear that he waves his hands and turns the water into wine. All we hear is that when the liquid reaches the chief steward and he tastes it, he certainly seems to think it's wine. And so do the rest of the wedding guests. But it's not so much alcohol that Jesus has applied to the party. It's joy. In this water become wine is a sign of joy and new life for the community. It's not just plonk. What he's providing is good wine, the best wine, the wine that God supplies out of the riches of the kingdom. It's not the usual rough red of the land. I actually went online to find out about the kind of grapes that are grown for wine in that part of the world. And when I Googled wine in Cana, the first hit was the Plonk Wine Club. That was not too attractive. But apparently there are still some red wines that are produced in the area, and they're mostly for unsuspecting tourists. You can purchase them from the Cana Wine and Souvenir Store outside the Latin Church, or similar establishments outside the Orthodox or the Annunciation Churches, or you can order online if you can't get to Israel, if you must. For those faithful who buy them in the hopes of sipping the beverage that Jesus provided, I think they might be a little disappointed. But it's not just the wine that they're drinking. It's the meaning behind it. I, however, have a much easier suggestion. Just come to church on Sunday. You see, every week we gather, when we ask God's blessing on the wine and the water that we provide, Jesus turns it into something more. It may start out as plonk from the liquor control branch and water from the tap, but in the presence of the Holy One, in the sacrament of the Eucharist, there is a change effected. Sure, you can tell it's still fairly sweet sherry when you have a sip at communion. It's over 14% alcohol, so it still does kill most of the bugs. And you may not like the taste very much. I've seen some of the faces. Some of you may not even want to imbibe it at all because of your allergies or your past experience with alcohol. That is okay. You can hold the cup reverently for a moment, or acknowledge it by just bowing your head before you go back to your seat. But what is in it is more than water. It's more than wine. Beyond those first impressions of just alcohol in a cup, there is a deeper meaning. In the power of the blood of Christ conveyed to you through that, you receive forgiveness and healing and fulfillment and joy. Yes, there is joy in the cup. In it, just as Cana, the glory of God is revealed to us. And it's so that we may be disciples to believe in the one who supplies the cup of salvation and the wine of new life. Perhaps once we've received it and experienced it for ourselves, we can do a better job at marketing that to the world. Amen.